Good evening, everyone. Welcome to, it's the first Tuesday of the month, so it's Mystic Time in the coolest place to be, the green room of Crosstown Concourse. And those of you listening to this podcast are not seeing the beautiful people I'm looking at, including, the coolest people are here tonight. And beside me are the Reverend Lillian Lammers, the Reverend Joshua Narcisse, the Reverend Dr. Scott Morris, and we have the dream team of music tonight. We have Dr. Ashley Davis, Karen Brown, and to get us started, freestyling Kirk Whalum. Eyes open or closed.
So what is the mystic? What is it that brings us here on the first Tuesday of the month? Well, it's not Muslim prayers on Friday. It's not Jewish prayers on Saturday or Christian prayers on Sunday. The mystic is a catalyst. Through music, story, silence, and dialogue, we hope to strengthen our attachment to hopes and dreams. In the mystic, diversity is a prerequisite for all creativity, which is why Crosstown Concourse is the perfect home. In the mystic, the world is far better served by our different beliefs than it could be ever if it were limited by rigid uniformity. And even if this doesn't rock your gypsy soul, as the lyrics to the song say, the goal of the mystic is not to feel better, but to get better at feeling. I ask that we each find the strength to open our hearts and treasure the differences that distinguish us. And may the music of compassion, kindness, spirit, and insight fill this hour.
We were born before the wind, so much younger than the sun. Ere the bonnie bow was worn into the mystic, a heart now here. Sailors cry, feel the wind, and taste the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic. And when that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. When that foghorn whistle blows, I want to hear it, I don't want to fear it. I want to rock your gypsy soul, just like days ago. And magnificently we will flow into the mystic. And when that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. When that foghorn whistle blows, I want to hear it, I don't want to fear it. I want to rock your gypsy soul, just like days of old. And magnificently we will flow into the mystic. And magnificently we will flow into the mystic.
All right, thank you, John. So on Thursday, it will be April the 4th, which is the 56th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination in Memphis. So the rest of the world may remember King on his birth date, January the 15th, but in Memphis, it will always be April the 4th. So we're going to talk tonight about what would King be involved in if he were still alive today. So, about 15 years ago, I think, I had the great privilege to interview Ambassador Andrew Young during a conference Church Health put on for parish nurses all over the country. We had the conference here, and we were fortunate to have Andrew Young come, and it was the first time he had actually been in Memphis, believe it or not, since that day on the balcony, you know, that iconic picture of him pointing his finger at the shooter. And I just asked the question that I thought everybody in the room wanted to know. And the question I asked him was, what were y'all thinking? You know, why were you here? What was the point of your coming to Memphis? And his response was not anything at all what I anticipated. You know, what he said was, we were just young pastors here trying to do what God had called us to do as pastors. They weren't here to change the world. They weren't trying to bring attention to themselves. They were trying to figure out what God was calling them to do. I don't think that's what a lot of people would have anticipated him saying, and I'm going to trust that that's how King would have answered the question himself. So, look, he was here in 1968 to deal with the sanitation workers' strike. You know, I don't know if things have gotten that much better in that regard, but I just ask you all, what if he were here today, what would he be caring about?
I'm not going to answer that. I would just want to say, I will. I want to hear from friends. His son will be here on Thursday at the National Civil Rights Museum at 4 o'clock to answer that question. If you have not experienced 6:01 p.m. at the National Civil Rights Museum on April 4th, it's one of the most riveting, emotional powerful moments.
But here, Mike, you've been on the board of the Civil Rights Museum since it got started.
Before I was born.
So, yeah.
Right. So, but yeah, I'm thinking, I mentioned King's son, but it's Kirk Whalum's dad of blessed memory, his friend, Reverend Billy Kyles, who many of us may remember, and the movie The Witness, that was an Academy Award documentary, short documentary about the last hour of King's life. And there's a moment at the end of the movie, because King would have been 95 years old, to your point about we were just young pastors. No one in that room made it to age 40. King was the oldest at age 39. And at the end of that documentary, Reverend Kyles looks in the mirror and he says, all the pictures and all the voices of King are this young pastor. And I look into the mirror and I see an 80-year-old man. And he says, all the photographs of King are in his 30s and 20s. What a price to pay for never growing old.
I hadn't thought about Kirk's father being involved there. Why don't you start? Would your...
Thank you, man. And my dad, Reverend K.T. Whalum, Sr., you know, you either loved him...
I loved him.
There were a lot of people who loved him, man, but there were plenty of people who didn't. Because he was just that... sharp edge, you know, where he's like, I'm slicing it like this, and I'm not going to apologize afterwards, you know. But yeah, you're right. I distinctly remember him being a part of it. He and so many clergy here in Memphis, and I think that's just the really important detail that the clergy in this town and in so many towns played such a pivotal part in the movement. And I think that's one of the distinctives of then and now, for instance, Black Lives Matter movement is pretty much, you know, kind of away from that. And there's not nearly as many clergy who are sort of welcome to take part in, I should say. But I'm glad my dad was a part of it. And I do remember, I always tell Ruby about, you know, being 9 years old when I heard about it and living a few blocks from there, you know, of him being killed, and just how I still to this day, but for sure, as a 9-year-old, I didn't know how to process it, you know. And I didn't quite understand who he was, obviously. I mean, you know, we had all heard of him and all of that, but to know how he looms large, you know, globally, and how Mandela was studying him. And, you know, and even the folks on the stage, you know, this is one of the things that I truly treasure about the Mystic and about being in Memphis at this time. Is being around a lot of people who are experts at Martin Luther King's words. Like, you know, I studied with Micah in seminary, and I got to hear about Martin King, you know, and to me, that's just so precious. You know, Lillian will preach about him, you know, Joshua will preach about him, and not in that way that you hear in certain parts of our society, where they basically kind of taken little snippets and make it say what they want to say, but they're not willing to deal with who he really was and how people really did not like him very much, you know, here in Memphis. But I did a documentary, I did a film, I did an album where I traveled to 8 countries and did collaborations with young artists, and it was called Humanité. Lots of people performing on it, it was amazing. But we documented it, and the documentary was called Humanité, the Beloved Community. And it's available on Amazon if you're interested. It's beautiful. But I say that to say that Martin King's vision is lived out on this stage, for sure. And it's lived out in this audience, you know. And it's being lived out in so many places, you know, the Beloved Community. And while it's so very important to recognize and celebrate the spiritual core, even Christian core, of how he spoke and what he said, it's really important, just as important, to acknowledge that it's bigger than any of that in the sense that of one little corner. It was huge. So the beloved community, that's the thing that I always want to wake up every morning with that.
Yeah. And that's why I think because of the beloved community, he would be, by the way, I tremble when people say, what would Martin Luther King care about today? You know, when you hear people representing things anathema to him, invoking him. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I won't get specific, but clearly as a prophet of nonviolence, he would be aghast at the avalanche of guns. I don't know how a prophet of nonviolence would not. Poverty, he was obsessed with poverty, even though he himself wasn't poor, which relates to healthcare legislations for black and brown communities in this country.
Yes, yes, yes.
I think he would be aghast at the targeting of migrants.
Yes.
That it's just obvious, like he would not be silent over what's happening over the whole targeting of migrants. And finally, you know, you reminded me with your dad, a blessed memory, the role of the black church in America. Mm. I think he would want to revisit that because you mentioned Black Lives Matter, and like what's interesting about King, he didn't endorse Kennedy. He was asked to endorse Kennedy in the Kennedy-Nixon election, and he said, I'm the head of this Southern, I want to get the letters right.
The SELC.
The SELC, right. And our role is to awaken the conscience of America, not to get behind a person.
Right.
Even though I believe looking back, Kennedy with the civil rights legislation and Nixon didn't emphasize that. He refused to endorse. And you look at the black church today and what impact is it making?
That's a good question.
I would think he'd revisit. I'll be quiet, but those are things that come to mind.
I went back and looked at how King spoke about the beloved community, and it is all about living in the nonviolence. You know, that is the definition for him of the beloved community, is his six principles of nonviolence. That's what leads to the beloved community. And then, you know, he was endlessly attacking what he referred to as the triple evils, which are poverty, racism, and militarism. That got him in trouble. Yeah. That third one definitely got him in trouble.
Yeah.
All right, but both of y'all were not born when the three of us were, but
you're closer to his age.
Yeah, we don't have memories of the assassination of Martin Luther King. But I've had the privilege, and you may have too, of sort of learning from folks who were King adjacent. So I was very blessed that the years that I was in seminary at Vanderbilt Divinity School, James Lawson was the scholar in residence. And so was able to hear him, sit in classes with him, and that was incredible. When I first heard this question of what would he be marching about today, the first thought was, same stuff, different day. Like it looks different, but you know, there's the disparities in healthcare outcomes, the disparity in education. You know, the average black family in this country has 1/8 of the accumulated wealth of the average white family, and that number's not changing. So I think things look different. You can, but I also think, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, which was and is very controversial, in the way that I think King's movements were. It's about the same thing. Like, yes, you can sit at a lunch counter next to white people now, but Black Lives Matter came from the murder of Trayvon Martin, who wasn't allowed to walk down the street in a neighborhood where he lived without being profiled and targeted and essentially followed. So that the message is still, you don't belong in this space. And so I think a lot of the core issues would be the same. All of the things that he preached about and he talked about and that he rallied people around, I think are still very much present in society. Yeah.
So Joshua is our young pastor.
And y'all have took all the good answers.
Save the best for last.
You know, I think that, you know, like you said, those three evils of poverty, sometimes interchanged it with extreme materialism, and then militarism and racism, right, would guide so much of what he would do, which means he would be dealing with all the things we've lifted up. I wonder, and I imagine that he'd probably be doing, I think near the end of his life, he was, as he was working with SNCC and trying to figure out how to engage with SNCC, engage with the young people in the movement, he was trying to figure out what his role was going to be as the Black Baptist preacher that is used to being in charge, right? And figuring out, how do I work with these other activists that are here? And I would like to imagine that if he was here today, he'd be trying to find a way to be a convener, right, of all of these, in the same way that he was, you know, working with E.D. Nixon and working with A$AP Philip Randolph and trying to work within these intergenerational partnerships and pull them all in the same direction, right? I think he'd be trying to do the same thing with Black Lives Matter, with all these different movements that are all essentially working toward the same thing. How do we coalesce, right? Which is an inherently uncomfortable thing, but how do we build this coalition where we know we aren't all going to get what we want, but or we can be working with each other, not at cross purposes. There is, what I love about the modern movement, modern civil rights movements, is that they are essentially decentralized in terms of their leadership for a reason, right? We had all of these leaders and you kept killing them, right? You took out Dr. King, you took out Malcolm X, you took out Robert Kennedy. Mm-hmm. You have these so-called leaders that you are able to then target. And so I like the fact that it is decentralized, but that hampers our ability to coordinate, right, and increases the ability to compete. And so I would think that Dr. King would be trying to find a way to play behind the scenes that role of convener and coordinator to address those three triple evils that continue to show their head in new and fantastic ways with each generation.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Yeah, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah, picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, oh, what's going on, what's going on, oh, what's going on, what's going on. Mother, mother, everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us simply 'cause our hair is long? You know we've got to find a way bring some understanding here today. Yeah. Picket lines, picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on and talk to me so you can see what's going on. What's going on? Tell me what's going on. I tell you what's going on. What's going on? 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 What's going on?
Kirk, you ain't allowed to play the horn like that no more.
Sounds like it's music in the movement tonight.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
As always.
That was wonderful, y'all. So before we get back into it, Micah, you and I clearly missed the memo. Where are your Converse All-Star finishes?
Come on.
Don't leave home. We just do what Lillian does, okay? Just wherever she goes.
Oh, no, 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 no.
This is a youth group.
I think you're right about that. So the night before King's assassinated, as we all know, he preaches the Bend to the Mountaintop speech, which begins with, there is something happening in Memphis. So what did he mean by that?
The most powerful line in that sermon, first of all, he had more death threats against his life, and I only know this because of Reverend Kyle's and your father's generation. It was such terrible weather that night, like this morning's storm that came through. The shutters were banging, and he jumped because could have been a gun. And King and Abernathy walk into Mason Temple. Excuse me, Kyles and Abernathy walk in because King is back at the Lorraine. He's back at the Lorraine. And Kyles and Abernathy notice the place is packed. And he said, our people usually don't come out in the weather. So he called King and said, they've come out to hear you. And while everyone talks about the mountaintop, he did soften it, according to Kyles, because he said, I may not get there with you. He didn't say, I will not get there with you. As in other speeches, he had sometimes said that. But what was going on in Memphis was he was determined to have a nonviolent march, back to all of your points, Joshua, about the nonviolence. Mm-hmm. But the line that always haunts me is when people asked him, why are you coming back to Memphis if you've had all these death threats? Why are you, here was a PhD, oratorical skills off the chart, the Woodruffs, Coca-Cola, wanting them to be on every board, could have been president of Emory. And he died defending garbage workers on a balcony for a 10-cent raise. And when he was asked why he did that, he said, the question is not what will happen to me if I help the sanitation worker. The question is, what will happen to the sanitation worker if I do not? Mm-hmm. So that's why he came back. I mean, he was obsessed with this altruism that is anathema to the culture we're living in right now. So I think Memphis is, it's a terrible word to use, a testing ground. I don't want to say a laboratory because that has connotations, but it's a testing ground for all the ills that he was obsessed in correcting, I think. But that line is the line, not the mountaintop to me. It's what will happen to my patient, not what will happen to me.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
What does that mean for us today? I mean, you know, we don't live in the past 56 years ago. I mean, we live in this moment today, and, you know, if something is happening in Memphis, what, how does this become personal to us? You know, what is it that we need to be involved with?
Lillian said, not much has changed. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, it's been 56 years, and we don't live in the past, but indeed that past informs right where we are now. Some things die hard, right, that there are still, and there are choices that were made 56 years ago that still shape the community we live in, right? And we know all the structural things that play into it, right? That North Memphis looks the way it does for a reason, right? That Orange Mountain looks the way it does for a reason. That, you know, when you cross a certain part of Central Avenue and Lamar, things look the way they do for a reason. It's not happenstance. And so the community we live in is still shaped by decisions and conversations that were had 50, 60, and 70 years ago. And so there's, when we think about Memphis as this place of possibility, maybe that laboratory place of possibility where these things can happen, it required, I think King saw that so much of what was wrong had been made the structure and the fabric of the city. And that if it could work in Memphis, it can work everywhere else. Mm. Right. And we might not be 56 years in the past, but the beneficiaries and the, I want to say victims, those who have been harmed by the system continue to play and exist in those roles, right? And so how do we, and by existing in those roles, trying to make it plain, as Daddy King would tell Dr. King when he was preaching, he would get too eloquent and too high-minded, say, make it plain, I'm trying to make it plain. We exist in those roles. We're the beneficiaries of those decisions that were made 67 years ago, or those who have been harmed by those decisions. And existing in those roles have helped us to be much more segregated than we like to think we are, even though we're able to sit at the lunch counter. Yeah. And so if we continue to live in this spiritual segregation, let's call it that, then how are we able to ask that question that King is asking, to be serious about, as one preacher in the city said, my liberation is tied up with yours, mm-hmm. right? There's no, I don't get free by myself. I have to be concerned about what's going on with you in order for me to be well, right? There is that mutuality. There's no losing it. But because we are continuing to play the roles that we've been cast in 60 and 70 years ago and not break out of character, we continue to participate in the same play.
I think my answer is a little bit different. Rather than thinking that Memphis, that these bad things are so deeply entrenched, so if it works here, it can work anywhere. I'm going to go to what we've talked about so many times up on this panel, which is that there is a heart in Memphis, there is a soul in Memphis, and it existed in the 60s too. And if you've ever done the tour at Stax Museum, they talk about that soul and how it had the ability to bring people together across racial lines and see each other as siblings. And I wonder, for me, because I've lived here for almost 6 years now, I've kind of bought into it. I've bought into the heart, soul, touchy-feely parts of Memphis. I think it's real. I've seen it in action. I wonder if that is why this is the testing ground. This is the place, because the possibility is there if someone will lead, if someone will open eyes, and show people the way. I think the question for me that sits behind this conversation is, if King were marching today, which side would I be on? which side would my church be on? Because we all like to look back and remember that and think, well, yeah, I would have been on the side, but so few were, including some at times the NAACP. Right. And so I think I hear that question and I put it as a charge back to myself to say, well, this work is still happening. This movement is still happening. Where are you in it? Because if you're sitting on the sidelines, if you're being silent, then you know, what's King's quote? It's when you go through the room in the Civil Rights Museum with the garbage truck, and there's some quote playing that talks about I'm being less concerned about the Klansmen and more concerned about
the
white moderate who's more interested in preserving the status quo than justice.
Yeah.
And that is a horrible citation of it. I'm sure I butchered it. But yes, the negative piece.
Tension.
Yes, the absence of tension rather than the presence.
The presence of justice.
That is it, yes. And so I ask that back to myself in the midst of so many issues that feel so familiar to that day.
Yeah. Look, I think we...
Hey, could the former Soulsville Stacks person
absolutely
vamp on what she said? Is that true?
Vamp on it.
Is what she said resonate?
Well, first of all, I'm just still, you know, pinching myself, Dr. Lammers, you know, that you are here for such a time as this, that you can speak to an audience that not everybody can speak to, and you are off the chain. Somebody needs to just reel you in, because you were just out there doing your thing and you don't care what they think. And I'm just rah-rah, sis boom bah, is what I'm trying to say. But has anybody ever dealt with a stubborn pilot on the stove? Okay, you know, you're doing the right thing, but it will not light, right? So Scott Morris, Dr. Morris, invited me into a group where we study the great Father Richard Rohr. And one of the things that we talk about is the fact that there has to be some violence to that. I'm using it in this metaphor of the pilot to make that thing light. Right? There has to be something that happens that strikes it and makes it, and you have to strike it again and again. And is it not true that what Martin's assassination did was to light a pilot that was stubborn? Mm. Now, as much as certain sectors of this society keep trying to blow that thing out, Memphis is that place now with a stubborn pilot that won't go out. In other words, what do we have here? Some kind of way we got Joshua here. We got a Scott Morris over there. He's speaking to people with a lot of dough, saying, I know you want to give this to this museum and that museum, but let me put this in front of you right now. There are people of color who deserve the same health care you have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? White people speaking this message to other white people. Women speaking this message to men. It's a stubborn pilot, and I just don't know if it would have happened without the violence to make that thing light.
I think he also saw the most powerful four-letter sign in terms of Daddy King saying, you got to bring it down. Didn't say peace, love, or justice. I am a man. Eighth grade graduates, because that's the way the schools worked. Mm-hmm. And I think he saw what both you, Lillian, and Joshua both said in Memphis. He saw that light. I mean, I can only imagine being there to hear Reverend Kyles talk about when those men came out of the church and walked. Who are you if you're not a human being and a child of God? And that's exhibit A, right? Mm, mm. For the common humanity in the face of that violence. Mm-hmm.
So I think the way you see this is shaped by your daily experience. And for me these days, more than half the people who come to Church Health speak Spanish. And in my CN patients, some days, everybody speaks Spanish. And, you know, if you watch the news and all, you would assume that, you know, people who cross the southern border, they've been here for, I don't know, 2 weeks. But do you know the average length that a Spanish-speaking immigrant has been in the United States? 15 years. Wow. 15 years. And then when you start thinking about what they contribute to the American society and the American economy, our economy would implode without them. And there are just certain things that I don't think most people just ever ponder on. So in Tennessee, you know, they pay as much tax as we do, in that we don't have an income tax. They, you know, pay sales tax. They, when they pay their rent, you know, they rarely own homes because they aren't able to own homes. And then here's the point that I think almost nobody gets. Our social security system is born on their back because they know in Washington that in their jobs, social security gets taken out of their checks. And they know they will never have to pay a dime for any of them because they'll never qualify for it. Without that money, social security would implode. Mm-mm. So how can that not be one of those things that we care deeply about? But I don't see it. You know, I don't see that this is the thing that people want to march in the street over. Because people are undocumented and they have the fear of what would happen to them. And every Latino patient I see, even if they were born in Memphis or born in Texas, they all have fear around immigration because somebody they care deeply about, they're afraid could be deported tomorrow. And that fear is the thing that I think King stood against more than anything else. Yeah. People should not have to live in fear.
Yeah, I think that's what continued to make him so unpopular, right? King kept taking a sledgehammer to the idea of the other.
Yes.
Right, that I am a man, I am a human being, I'm a self-actualized person that you have to pay attention to, right? And so I think you're completely right. He would be on the side of immigrants, but you can't other me. You can't make me the boogeyman.
That's right.
Right, I am a full human being that is part of this beloved community as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad we resolved that. But Karen, let's hear your next song. All right.
So this is a song that John Kilzer and I wrote on a napkin. In fact, some of you were there. It was the Starks dinner. Yeah, and somebody said something, and then John and I looked at each other. He said, "That's it. If unless all of us are free, none of us are free." And the song just developed from there.
Until we're all free until we're all free. Not just you and me.
The colors of the rainbow,
colors of the rainbow,
shine in harmony
when we're all free. Standing on the backs of angels, staring out to sea. There upon the blue horizon, shimmering for you and me.
Sand and stone, salt and light, heart and hand, take up the fight for victory.
Y'all can sing this.
Until we're all free.
Ain't nobody free.
Ain't nobody free. Until we're all free. Not just you and me.
The colors of the rainbow.
Colors of the rainbow.
Shine in harmony.
Oh, yes, they do.
When we're all free.
The dreams that we will reap tomorrow are seeds that we will sow today. Before you buy into the song, listen to your children pray.
The voices care in the wind, treasures friend.
Till we're all free. Ain't nobody free. Until we're all free. Not just you and me.
The colors of the rainbow.
The colors of the rainbow.
Shine in harmony.
Oh, yes, they do.
When we're all.
Until we're all free,
ain't nobody free. Until we're all free.
It's the Mystic Tabernacle Choir.
Not just you and me.
Colors of the rainbow.
Colors of the rainbow.
Shine in harmony.
Oh, yes, they do.
And to every one of us.
And every one of
no,
us.
No, not just some of
no,
us.
No, not just some of us.
Until we're all.
All free.
Glad the program wasn't that good at that dinner we went to, so you and John could write that on the napkin.
Oh, man. Well, I've got our meditation for this evening. And of course, since we're talking about Dr. King, who's better words to read than his? We've been referencing it every now and then during our conversation. I'm going to read an excerpt from a letter from a Birmingham jail. Now, I love how he ends the message, ends his letter. He apologizes for it being so long. He says, perhaps it would have been shorter if I were writing at a more comfortable desk. When you've got dull days of monotony in a narrow jail cell, what else do you do but write long letters, think strange thoughts, and pray long prayers.
Mm. But hold on a second, Reverend Joshua. So you have these white preachers up here that God has called above the fray to see above the hedges so that we might be God's beloved community. But who was he writing to on that particular day?
To the fence sitters that Lillian was talking about.
Well, he was actually right. Joshua and I were with a pastor from Birmingham this afternoon who absolutely would have been one of the people he was writing to.
A Memphian's grandfather, the Episcopal minister, the Methodist minister, and the rabbi who all preached about justice.
Yeah.
But
sorry about that, brother.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I think it ties in well with what King says. He kind of picks up mid-thought. He says, I've tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent from those who are under the weight of oppression can be channeled through the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. Now, this approach, this nonviolent direct action, this approach is being dismissed as extremist. I must admit, I was initially disappointed in being so categorized. But as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a bit of satisfaction from being considered an extremist. Was Jesus not an extremist in love? Love your enemies, bless those that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the gospel of Jesus Christ? I bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God. Was not John Bunyan an extremist? I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a mockery of my conscience. Was not Abraham Lincoln an extremist? This nation cannot survive half slave and half free. Was not Thomas Jefferson an extremist? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be an extremist, but what kind of extremists will we be? Will we be extremists for hate, or will we be extremists for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice, or will we be extremists for the cause of justice? Amen.
Amen.
Well, thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. And for those of you who are listening on the podcast, we'll be doing this again on May 7th. May the 7th, right?
Yes.
And just, you want to get your tickets right now, Kirk? Cafe Kirk will be on June the 2nd, and yes, you're releasing a new album. Just yes, say a word about that.
Yes, it's the release of, finally got a new record out. The pandemic set me back. But yes, so a new record is called Epic Cool, and we're going to have a release party. It has lots of folks who are on the record, including my producer, who is, I call Swiss Chocolate. He's a brother from Switzerland. And his name is Greg Manning, and Andrea Lisa, my guitarist from New Zealand, and just really excited to do this. And it's my mom's birthday, so she'll be 87.
All right, the last few Cafe Kirks have sold out almost immediately, so get your tickets. So, all right, Karen, y'all take us out.
Martin yelled over the balcony to make sure that his favorite sax player, Ben Branch, would play this particular song. And by the way, it really means a lot to me because, you know, Karen, I hear you sing and I hear these great singers and these orators, these preachers, and I go, what in the world am I doing? You know, we got a saxophone. But in that moment, you know, wow, it's like he really canonized the voice of the saxophone for the movement. Right, with this song. And if you don't know the lyrics and the backstory to Precious Lord, Take My Hand, you gotta look that up. Just Google it, because it's powerful. But this was his song, and Ben Branch played it. Mm-hmm.
I'm tired. I am weak. I am worn through the storm and through.
See you next month.
Yep. Wow, it's definitely a Memphis thing.
Yeah.